Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Hoovering, the podcast about eating. I'm Jessica Fostercue. I love eating as much as anything else in the world, but also it sometimes brings me conflict, shame, and all sorts of other things that are rubbish. It's complicated and I think fascinating. This is a conversation with an interesting soul, not just about food, but about gobbling it up, or if you will, hoovering.
Hello and welcome. Sorry, I sound a bit snotty because I am a bit snotty. Oof, this is one of my favourites so far. I don't mind saying it. Let's get the admin out of the way. Hello, I'm Jess. How are you? If you like this podcast, can you tell other people about it? Cheers. Also, if you like this podcast, the reason I am able to do it is because some kind people, although not enough yet, give me some money every month. And it means I can spend the massive amount of time that it takes to do this podcast. And hopefully eventually I can grow it and stuff and do some travelling with it and stuff like that. Anyway, there's this website called patreon.com, patreon.com/thehooveringpod, and go and have a look and you'll see, because from as little as $2 a month, I'm swapping, I think, some really brilliant and unique and interesting extra content and interesting rewards. They're called rewards, and there's like different tiers of different amounts a month that you can give, and you could stop it if you can only afford a few months of it or whatever. Anyway, I think it's brilliant. I think I'd be honoured if you give it a look. patreon.com/thehooveringpod. If you are one of my patrons already, my God, the love I have for you is big. Also, a couple of live versions of this podcast in January are the next ones coming up, 27th and 28th in London, in Islington, at the Hen and Chickens Theatre. If you want tickets, they are flipping, flying away. And I haven't even announced any guests yet, although I have booked some. I'm going to announce them in a batch. I think I'll announce them in a bunch. Maybe next week. Okay, next week. If you want the last few tickets, hurry, they're at unrestrictedview.co.uk/the-hoovering-podcast-live. Also, were you to become my patron, if you give $5 a month or more, you get discounts on those tickets to all of my live events. That's cool, isn't it? Do you want to come and see me do some stand-up? I've got some new material nights. It's called Honers Club, H-O-N-E-R-S, and it's at the Camden Head in Camden, and there are 3 dates in December, the 3rd, the 6th, and the 10th. There's been some reshuffling of the acts that I'm on with, but they include people like Bridget Christie and Josie Long. and Jen Brister and Susie Ruffle and Kiri Pritchard-McLean. Oh, I could go on, but I won't. Just buy tickets. They're only £3 in advance. I've done that on purpose so that you can afford to come. And there are still some left for those December dates. Go to wegottickets.com and search within that website for Honers Club. Okay, today's guest is one who I'm so happy to get in the bag. I travelled all the way up to Edinburgh to meet Louise Gray, where she cooked me a wild rabbit, which has been killed as part of the control around her local butcher's allotment. Amazing. So Louise is a journalist and an author, if you didn't already know, whose book, The Ethical Carnivore, totally knocked me for six. If you listen to this podcast regularly, you'll maybe have heard me wanging on about it, actually, that for months after I read it, that's just probably only just been months, but for weeks and weeks after I read it, it's all I wanted to talk about with everyone I met. The book is a candid and intensely compelling journey of hers, where as an environmental journalist trying to question and justify her carnivorousness, she spent a year only eating things that she'd killed herself. See, you'd heard of it, right? You'd heard of it. It's absolutely brilliant, and as you'll hear, she's just as fascinating, informed and compelling in person. Hence, I found it impossible to edit this one down very much, so it's a bit long, sorry, but I think you'll agree it's totally worth it. You join us as I ogle her adapted recipe for World War II rabbit, which incidentally, if you become a patron, will be in my December guest recipes, actually. And yes, so obviously I'm going to eat meat in this episode because I think it's a pretty unique and fascinating situation, actually. And exactly the sort of situation in which I would and will eat meat. I hope you enjoy it. I think if you've any interest at all in ethics of eating and where food comes from and disordered eating, we're pretty open about that, and then this will be a juicy one for you. Okay, let's do it.
I meant to print this out before you came.
Oh yes,
isn't it cool?
That's amazing.
And some of the recipes that we
use. Is that JPEGs or is it?
It's JPEGs, I can forward them to you.
Yes, it's a World War II rabbit recipe.
Yeah. But it's not, because I haven't used lard, because I'm not good at attention to detail, and you know, I didn't really want to buy a block of lard. I just knew I wouldn't use it.
Golden brown fried rabbit.
Yeah.
Whoa. I just got my hands on my grandmother's recipe book that she was given.
I've got mine.
Have you?
Yeah.
When they got married, they would be given a blank book with a few recipes already written in by hand.
Yes.
So that you would... Your husband would never go hungry.
Yes, yes.
Some of the recipes in that are off the charts.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God, what are some of the weirder ones? Yeah. Fried cod balls.
Yes! My granny actually printed them out.
Oh, wow, what an organised granny.
She had an American cousin who did it for her.
Okay, so I like it.
The detail's lovely, because if this particular cake... She'll say fresh eggs or five-day-old eggs. Just presume that you're using your own eggs.
That's a met that you'll have met the chicken and you've gone and got it that morning or five mornings ago.
Yeah.
It means you'd have also... Oh.
Which is lovely. And
also the assumption there that the care and time that's going into cooking, really, is...
Meringues. Eggs must be at least 5 days old.
Is there a science behind that?
I guess so.
Don't do something chemically that five-day-old ones do.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so I've got those, and I've got my mum's recipe book as well.
I love
it. It's such a nice thing, isn't it? But yeah, I looked up the rabbit recipes, because when I was writing the book, I talked about rabbit.
Yes.
There were quite a few older people who said to me, oh, I grew up on it.
Really?
Yeah, because in World War II... Obviously, there was rationing of meat.
Right.
And so people would kill a lot of wild rabbit. And the government actually encouraged people...
to hunt rabbit?
No, to raise them.
Oh, great.
So, you know the Dig for Victory book? I've actually got the Dig for Victory book advising people how to garden. Yeah. And there's two really interesting things about it. One, they use like quite a lot of chemicals.
Oh, really? It's not okay. So not great for birds and bees and...
Yeah. It was about feeding people. Yeah. And two, they had, you know, you put a rabbit hutch at the back.
Yeah.
So a rabbit hutch was part of feeding yourself.
Yeah.
And yeah, people... So, but loads of people got...
Not chickens. I mean, that's kind
of... Yeah, I guess there must have been chickens as well. But rabbits were really popular, and they had loads in the countryside anyway.
Maybe rabbits are a cuddlier pet. They were an easier sell as an all-round
family thing. And to eat, because laying chickens in this country aren't that great to eat. But, you know, all this interesting stuff that isn't in the book, I found out. Like, one of them was that people do eat laying hens, and in fact, egg chicken farmers have to be quite careful, because when people come up to pick up charitable hens, they're often people who just want free chickens, and they're often ethnic communities or the French, like coq au vin. You know, actually, in this country, loads of chicken recipes are designed for older chickens.
Right.
But you don't get older chickens.
For ages and
you don't get older chickens in the supermarket.
Yeah, because they grow them for 3 minutes and then they're sold.
Yeah.
So, oh, wow. Fascinating.
But these are, those are all these recipes that I've adapted.
Love it.
To make.
I don't think I've ever eaten rabbit before.
Really? Yeah. I thought you'd say that.
My partner is like, they used to have a rabbit and something pie when he was a kid. His mum is an amazing cook, and she would cook very English, very hearty, homely stuff for them when they weren't away at school. And he has like really happy childhood memories of some kind of rabbit pie.
Yes, it's delicious. Yeah. It's such a delicious meat.
Oh, I'm excited.
Much tastier than chicken. I really hope I haven't screwed up my recipe, because I didn't really follow a recipe. I added apple and marrow because
amazing.
There was loads.
Yeah, so I think there's loads.
Yeah. And I think it is a delicious meat. And it is, in this country, you have to be careful, because if you go to a restaurant or a butcher, you'll be getting French rabbit.
Oh, will you?
A lot of the time. A lot of the time, it depends. So you have to ask. Because... But like my butcher, this is where I've got it today, I got it from George Bauer, and they actually get some of them in from the allotment.
Wow.
Because they're controlled, but they get them from the countryside.
Yeah.
But restaurants that want consistent fat rabbits will probably get them from France. Because wild rabbits, you know, I don't know if I'm feeding you a buck or a doe, how tough it is, how old it is, how young it is. All those sorts of things. So it's
chefs are perhaps prioritising
inconsistent. Chefs who know what they're doing be fine, but if you want to, it depends on what you're cooking. And actually, chefs sometimes want a young domesticated rabbit, but no one's raising them in this country. I know a chef who's desperate to get people to raise organic.
Surely he can commission someone.
He's trying. It's called Fred Burtman, and he is trying in Scotland. I don't know if there's any. Rabbit farms in England. Yeah.
In Dorset, where I'm from, there's a place called Pig on the Beach.
There's
a place called the Pig on the Beach. There's like three of them now. There's one in the New Forest. But they have, in the grounds, they have all their own orchard and garden and everything.
Yeah.
And tiny little farm lot. And they've got all their own rabbits and everything.
Yeah.
Such a great idea. I wanted all the pets as a child, but never a rabbit. I think just assumed I'd get an evil one.
Yes, they can be really evil. And they can be really violent.
And then that's the one you have for dinner first, right? I want to talk about your amazing book. I think it's so brilliant. I'm going to put links to it, obviously, in all the podcast notes. I just wanted to start with a bit of brown nosing. I think it's very rare. I think it's happened to me a handful of times ever that I've read a book and then gone... Oh, I think that's going to change how I think fundamentally.
Oh, wow, okay.
And that's really exciting. Thank you. And I think because I've been working on my own disordered eating, but I'll talk about that later, but also in terms of just ethics, been really, really beginning with a flirtation with veganism that had become, then I got more and more serious in that.
Yeah.
And I think when I read a book and it changes the way I think, most recently, what it's done is taken me off a very absolute and what was becoming a very firm and finite decision and reminds me to be more flexible and to never have finished making up my mind.
Yeah.
And I think what I'd been looking for in the way I eat and the way I source what I eat, I'd been missing the point a bit, and your book made me realise it's actually a connection.
Yes,
and so I've got loads of questions around that. It felt like that was one of many revelations that you had over the course.
Yeah, it was
of
really slow. I mean, one of the reasons I was never absolute in it is, I don't know whether this really happened at the beginning, but I knew that I would never preach something I couldn't stick to myself.
Yeah,
and I know myself well enough, and also people will potentially pick up the book in 10 or 20 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to make promises I can't keep.
Yeah.
And then the philosophical side is really interesting because there are such interesting absolute philosophers. Well, I mean, I think Plato and Aristotle and people like that talked about being vegetarian and vegan, yeah, and not eating meat. Whether they did or not, I'm not sure, mm-hmm, because I feel like Byron were meant to be vegetarian, but I don't think he was. You know, yeah, it's always been something people have said because philosophically it sounds right. And then there are modern philosophers who are really good, a guy called Peter Singer.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's amazing, and there's a very famous book, which the name escapes me, but his argument is that we're equal to animals, you know, and we shouldn't be using them in any way. Mm. And it makes perfect sense. It's really powerful.
Really?
Yeah. And you read it and you think, right, I must be like that. And then it, for me, it fades, mm-hmm, with my life. And I have read other philosophers like Julian Baggini, who, mm, he's written a book called The Virtues of the Table, which is looking at, things like vegetarianism and then to veganism and saying, well, what would happen to parts of the country where you control pests? What would happen to, you know, animals that hunt other animals? And like looks at it in the round and looks at a more
holistic.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to say realistic because I'm actually quite, having written the book, most vegans and vegetarians are really supportive of it.
Yes.
Because most people, or a large proportion of people, are vegan or vegetarian because they don't really want to eat factory farm meat.
Yeah.
And then there are people who are fundamental vegans who believe killing is wrong.
Yes.
And I continue to have conversations with those people.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I accept a contradiction.
Yes.
People often say to me, is it justified? And you're like, how can I say it's justified when I have a gun?
Mm-hmm.
And the rabbit doesn't.
Yeah.
There's no justice there.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to justify it. I explain. I've never expected this after I shot a deer that I would feel defiant, but I did, yeah, a bit because it didn't. It does feel like you're pushing against something natural. You know, yeah, you're pushing against the love you have for the animal and life. Yeah. You know, you are a human. You appreciate all those things, but then you also sort of reach through that boundary.
It's absolutely fascinating. That love for the animal and that feeling like you're pushing against something natural, yeah, were you to kill it, it sort of feels countered in two ways, in the sense that on the one hand we're also just so much more squeamish than we've ever been before historically,
yes,
because we can be.
Yes,
because
yes,
we can have so much distance,
yeah,
from what we're eating.
Yeah.
And we can consume things without any real time spent ever thinking about where it's from or what it ever was.
Yeah, yeah.
Perhaps it's almost anachronistic to... Maybe it's just a modern... It's such a modern feeling, is it? To be like, but I love the... I don't know. No,
well,
you're saying that
there are really
the philosophies are ancient.
I think, no, exactly. I think that, you know, the Red Indians had a prayer to say to the animals, you know,
yeah,
and there's lots of stuff in culture, like halal,
yeah,
is really just a way to get your head around killing an animal.
Yeah.
So it's not, we've actually always worried about this, and it goes back a long way in time.
Yeah.
Like I said, Greek philosophers went on about it, and there are whole, you know, ancient religions which don't allow you to eat meat because of all these reasons and stuff.
Yeah.
We've always worried about it. And one of the interesting things I learnt when I did a home slaughter of a pig,
yeah,
was after you've killed the pig, you spend all day processing it,
yeah,
in a community.
Yeah.
And you're talking about what you've done all day and you're making sense of it. You know, the comparison of when I went to an abattoir and you walk away, and there's no way to make sense of it. But
yeah,
when you...
Part of the book was...
Yeah.
I think I sort of took a break at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
It's just like, I just...
It's really awful.
Say, this doesn't sound horrific.
Yeah, so, but I think that a lot of, you know, when we're doing it all together...
Yeah.
We're making sense of it, so...
Yeah.
I kind of think that's part of the...
And also just using what there is to feed,
yeah,
the people that there are.
Yeah, and you know what
I mean? That's very different, I think, to... I don't know... I think eating in a way where you're happy to use what there is in the sea and in the land.
Yeah.
is totally different to going, all right, I'm going to have a day off lunch, so I'm going to go and get the 9-piece bucket.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, so I don't think those people care any less.
No.
And it's really interesting, whenever you talk to farmers, they have thought about it.
Yeah.
They've all thought about
and
it.
And they'll love animals, like, yeah, more than anyone else you'll ever
meet.
Yeah,
need, and
have this connection with them. Yeah,
people who have to be, well, they don't have to be a source meal. I mean, I guess it is an element of choice, though. I'd argue that it's money and class and opportunities and all sorts of things involved
in
that.
And people who end up being slaughtermen.
Yeah, yeah. Though that is a quite well-paid job. But people have usually thought it through, but they do talk about having to have a disconnect.
Yeah.
And people often said that to me about cognitive dissonance, when you're distancing yourself from what you're...
Like surgeons must have.
...doing. I guess so. But then their ultimate goal is saving lives. But then they're sort of going to say their ultimate goal is feeding people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so not everyone's thought it through, but the farmers I spoke to generally had. They didn't really want to talk about it. They generally had. And it's really...
trying to make them talk about their feelings.
Yeah, it was quite hard work. And the really interesting thing happened to me when I wrote this book.
Yeah.
I'd be around people at a party or maybe even just meeting someone randomly, and they knew I was writing the book, and they'd get me to one side and tell me about when they had to kill an animal.
Really? So I met, so you've heard everybody's
old man who'd accidentally killed an owl when he was young. And then there was like someone who'd like their first rabbit and it screamed and gone round in circles. Someone actually talked to me about squashing ants. And it was like they wanted absolution from their guilt, and they'd never been able to talk about it, especially men who often spent their whole lives hunting and shooting, but they'd been taught really young to do it, and they'd never had the opportunity to talk about it or how they felt. And they were almost like coming to me at this point, and sometimes I was like, I don't know, what? But it's really interesting that people do want to process it and talk about it. And that was one of the motivations in the book, is that you're either vegetarian / vegan or you eat meat. But there wasn't much conversation by the people in between, because it was so shameful to admit that you eat meat and question it. Because if you question it, then don't do it. Yeah. Some people might remain in that camp. Yeah. It's not like in the past, everyone says, oh, in the past we all did it.
Yeah.
But we didn't, probably. We all shared it, didn't we?
Yeah.
And there were different roles for different people in a society. Yeah. Lots of people have misinterpreted the book and said, if you want to eat meat, you have to kill animals yourself. And I'm like, no, because it took me 2 years and I learnt those skills and I'm going to continue to use them.
To feed other people with
them
that might get those skills.
And it's not happening a lot because of my lifestyle, but I ultimately can. And I took it really seriously. It takes a long time to learn how to use a fishing rod and a gun and things. And I still haven't even started, but I would at some point quite like to improve those skills and keep with them. So I didn't do it as a one-off. And I think like doing it as a one-off wouldn't teach you anything.
No.
Because each time you do that and you take responsibility is a big thing, but I don't think you can do it and then it's sorted.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I never thought people should do it, should follow me like in that sense. But I thought I was giving them, if they wanted, that information. But I guess when you get back to your friend who doesn't want to know, I find it hard to force people. Because lots of people have said to me, oh, you know, it's terrible, people don't want to know. And there was a sort of famous Twitter thread after George Monbiot ate some roadkill. And I remember one woman in particular who was literally like, I would eat chicken from a supermarket, but I wouldn't eat this. And he sort of went mental on her, but it was like, he was like, don't you understand the contradiction what you're saying? And I don't really sort of get involved in those things because they can just go on. But I was looking at it thinking that person's in their silo and I don't think they're climbing out. So I don't know. I want to talk to people who are willing. And I don't want to shock or appall people either.
No. But then you don't... It's surprising how little it takes to shock and appall some people.
Yes. Eating rabbits.
Yeah.
No, eating rabbit would shock
really
and appall a lot of people.
It. Yeah, it would. How funny.
Yeah.
I can see, in the positive way, a future where people are, through necessity and through caring about the environment, ethics, love of animals, an increasing bent towards veganism.
Yes, certainly.
And I think...
It'll have to, because the planet
can't take. Yeah. I'm interested in the potential unhelpfulness in the absolutism of those labels.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm just going to copy you and call myself an ethical carnivore from now on, even though I'm going to, you know, I'm probably going to eat meat 2 or 3 times a year. Yeah, especially as I don't, I don't know that. Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to eat fish more often than that. But again, it's like, I just want to make sure I take the time. I just want to take the time to be careful about where I get it from. I'm not, I'm not purporting to going to be having the time in the next 5 years to learn how to get it. Get it myself. Yeah. I don't know. One thing I wonder if we've got the rise, let's just, to keep it simple, say the rise of veganism or even vegetarianism. I don't know. You talk about having quite long stretches of that.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand going, but when I do eat fish and animals, I want to see that that was an animal. I want to either get it from a butcher's or a farm or a fishmonger's and buy a whole fish and see its head, like, see what it is. Don't have a fish finger.
Ideally.
Yeah. But say you get that ideal setup, which would be my ideal setup for me.
Yeah.
Let's keep this really into this example. The only thing that jars a little bit is I find the longer I go without any animal products, the more squeamish I get about them.
Okay.
And I'll find that you'll walk past a carcass hanging in it. At the end of my road in London, there's an amazing whole carcass butcher who's, I mean, just very lucky to have him right there. Yeah. There are days where I walk past and the smell will make me shudder. Yes, and the sight of it will make me go, ugh.
Yeah.
And I think it's just, and so I don't know, I kind of,
I must admit that is quite interesting, because for me, when I was writing the book, I didn't eat much meat. Like, there's an appendix at the back.
Yeah.
And then people assume I know a lot about cooking meat.
Yeah.
But I only cook, like, 2 rabbits in the whole book.
Yeah.
Like, 1 deer and things like that. So I wasn't actually eating that much. And it is about familiarity and skills. And, you know, whenever you walk into the butcher, you know what, a few cuts, and there's so much potential in all the other things you can eat.
Yeah.
But it does take time and money.
Yeah.
Well, time is money, I guess. Because it doesn't necessarily need to make time if you can, everyone's always talking about cheaper cuts, but if you want to know how to cook them properly, then you've got to, like, take time.
And
if, you know, most of us are busy. So it just made me think, when you were talking about ideally you want a whole fish and stuff, but that's also quite hard work and takes familiarisation. And so I guess that's,
no one said
that to me before, but I guess that is a difficulty in saying you're going to eat less meat but good quality. It's quite hard work because you're not familiar with
you've turned yourself with a very natural kind of cooking. You get this revulsion from the animalness but then that's exactly the type, if you're going to dabble in it, of animal eating you should do, is the one that you've conceived as an animal.
I don't really find that. I love the smell. Like today when I sort of, I got the rabbit, I wanted to get rabbit in the fur so I could tweet about it before you got here, but I went to my I went to George Bowers and he was like, no, I've given them all to the scouts to skin.
Cool.
Which is kind of a cool thing that he does. So it's like, okay, I have one done really badly by a scout. And
Softy rabbit.
Yeah. And when I opened it, the smell, I think it's quite a nice smell. Gamey rabbit.
Yeah.
And it's familiarisation of what you know, but
it smells amazing cooking.
But I've always, and I don't like pork, and I've always found that a bit gross. And I
supposed
think
to be the closest to a person, isn't it?
It's very natural what you're feeling when you walk past a butcher's.
But I don't always have it.
I think it's so interesting how, if a really passionate chef was there with you, it would change your mind.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, if you met those chefs, like they'll be like, what about this and what about that? And sort of slapping their own body, and there's such a joy and respect in it. And that switches you onto it. And there's also a bit of a fascination in the dirty and the grim,
kind of morbidity and the morgish.
And the smells, you know, those things, like, you think that's bad, but then really stinky cheese smells bad, but...
Oh, awesome.
I'm not very good with it, but there are lots of things which don't look good.
Yeah.
That taste good.
So good. So,
yeah.
Delicious. There are 2 incredible statistics in your book.
Yeah.
There are hundreds, but yeah. I'm going to try not to be so mawkish as to read your book out at you.
Yeah.
But the two I've got here are 94% of soya production is for animal feed, not for vegans' tofu. And the other was that 30% of available ice-free surface area of the planet is being used either by livestock or to grow their food.
Yeah.
And those statistics...
And the soy one, that's GM soy, by the way.
Okay.
Most of that, I should think probably all of that is GM soy.
Wow.
So your mayonnaise, your eggs, your milk, most are from animals fed GM soy. But soy, people often sort of go, oh, well, you know, vegetarians are eating all this soy, but actually very little GM soy is being used in the production of tofu and things that vegetarians eat because it's such a small proportion of the market.
Yeah.
Most of it is for animal feed.
God. So those stats are like singing, screaming in favour of veganism, vegetarianism, veganism, really.
Yeah.
But because you hear so many people who say, well... You know, the amount of soy that's being grown is and you think, and then I read that and was like, oh, so that's not all going into corn. But two things off the back of those stats then.
And none of it's going into
corn. Maybe, no.
Yeah.
Maybe, and these maybe are two giant questions. But number one, do you think there's anything that vegans are eating in abundance which is fucking the planet?
Which isn't what?
Which is bad, for, like, you know, environmentally.
Oh, bad for the planet.
As much of...
fucking organic.
Like, fucking the planet up, I should say.
Oh, yeah, everything they're eating is. Everything you're eating
is. The stuff from far away. Everything you're eating is.
What do you think happened, you know? Like...
I know that my avocados have screwed the whole one of the edges of Peru and
shit. Yeah, and it's all coming from a melting glacier.
Wow.
In Peru. So a melting glacier in Peru, there's a big melting glacier in it coming down, it's irrigating these orchards. It is a good thing until the glacier runs out. But we're effectively eating climate change.
Yeah.
I'm kind of ahead of myself in my latest book here. But I think pretty much everything has an impact.
Yeah.
And I know a few people, and the few people I know who I'd say don't have an impact are...
Oh, God.
About 60 years old, and they're just...
Are they freegans?
No, they're proper, gentle, good, kind hippies who know how to make yoghurt and the difference between... and how to store apples and how to store potatoes and how to get a free pheasant. And they minimise where the rest of their food's coming from. I wish I could be like that, but I'm not.
Yeah.
But I hope I am one day. Those, and I'm pretty sure probably the freegans too. I struggle with it sometimes because I'm like, it's not that I know I couldn't do it. I'm like, do you occasionally wobble?
Yeah.
And if you wobble, do you lie?
Yeah.
Or
is there shame?
Or does one sort of talk about it? So veganism, I'm not, whenever anyone comes to me, I'm like, good for you.
Yeah.
I don't care, by the way, but, well, I don't care what you eat in terms of you must make your own decisions, but I can tell you, you've probably got a lower carbon footprint.
Yeah, great.
And no animals suffered.
Yeah.
And frankly, in a world where you can, where lots of people are really struggling to do anything to be good for the planet, then that's great. They can do that. So I don't criticise it. But when you ask, are there anything vegans are eating that are fucking up the planet? I'd say.
Really lots.
Quite a lot.
Yeah.
Like human existence is fucking up the planet. But
stop,
you know, you go down that
rule,
line.
As a basic practical rule, though, the further away it's come from, the less helpful you're being, planet wise.
I mean, possibly, not necessarily. So if you're getting tomatoes from Spain that have been grown outside, that has a lower footprint than tomatoes grown in a greenhouse here.
Really?
Or lamb from, this is a very famous one, they did a study that found that lamb from New Zealand had a lower carbon footprint because it's on such a scale in New Zealand and because of the weather, and then you put it into, it's all in a massive cargo ship, so it's relatively low, whereas you've got a sheep that are kept indoors over the winter and have to be transported by a lorry and all the rest of it. So the carbon footprint stuff can tie you in knots.
Yeah.
I think thinking about where your food comes from, it does tie knots. That's what it continues to do. But it just strikes me that's why I wrote the book. Like when I say everything.
No,
you
don't
do
come out of it thinking, yeah. Oh, I've got all the answers.
Yeah,
I know how
but
to
it's
live
kind
it.
Of one of the reasons I wrote the book is like when I said, oh, everything you do, like existing as a human screws up the planet. I mean, if you're an environment writer,
yeah,
that is what you wake up in the morning one day thinking, and you can either think, oh my God, it's over, or choose something that you can do.
Yeah.
And for me, that thing was food.
Say scrumdiddlyumptious.
No!
And then you can be in my podcast.
Scrumdiddlyumptious.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Have you got a leg and saddle?
I've got a leg and a saddle.
And a, well, a bit of saddle.
Right.
Not the whole saddle, that would be low.
Incredible. Look at a great big long carrot.
No! Rabbit and carrot.
Broad beans, no? Runners. No.
Runners.
Runners. And tell me what the carrots are again.
Well, they're actually called imperator carrots. And it's just because I'm weird and I've been visiting carrot farms recently. And so I got loads of different
for your
kinds
new
of
book.
Carrots. Yeah.
For visiting carrot farms.
Yeah.
Love it. There's a yellow one.
Yes.
And tell me what the potatoes are called again.
They're called pink fir apple.
Pink fir apple.
And then the rabbit is just wild British. Well, it's Scottish.
Scottish rabbit.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
And it's cooked in loads of marrow and apple because that's what
and
there
more
is.
Carrots.
And also a bit of bacon, which I wouldn't usually put in, but because I was looking at these Second World War recipes, they said.
Yeah. Do they?
Oh. It's a bit salty.
I love salty.
Okay, good. Well, actually, because I put the... And I just got ham and bacon ends because you can get really cheap stuff at butchers like that. They're just like, oh, do you just want to throw that in? And it's salt, and then I put stock in as well. So that's maybe too salty.
That is so large. It's not too salty at all. And with the apple, it doesn't... That's so tangy that it's... This is
large. I like the rabbit meat.
I love the rabbit meat.
Mm.
There was an article that went nuts a couple of weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago now, about a farm in Sussex or Suffolk, where they're doing lots of rewilding and stuff.
Yes, I know it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She's written a book.
Yes,
Yeah.
And that sounded really interesting.
Well, and they do eat the animals. So part of the rewilding is the control of the herbivores.
Okay.
So they want pasture.
Yeah.
But they can't have a herd of cattle that just grows exponentially.
Yeah.
So they control the animals. And that's part of it. But instead of taking it to the slaughterhouse, they go out and shoot them.
Yeah.
It's a big thing with rewilding because... Britain is a managed countryside.
Yeah.
And if you release wild boar, I've met farmers who've had their fields destroyed by wild boar. And everyone's like, oh, you know, they're such terrible farmers. Well, that was their profit, that field of turnips. It's, you know, you've got to be a little bit sympathetic. So some of the rewilding is controlling the animals as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we need much more of that in Scotland because we've got way too many deer.
Really?
Way too many deer.
So they're a great thing to learn
and
to go out.
No
and
one disagrees with that.
Right.
Yeah, but the it's so interesting.
I imagine I'll have a tweet from a vegan who disagrees with that.
Oh, yeah, but the history of Scotland has meant that we've got an overpopulation of deer, and most conservationists wouldn't disagree with that. But what they disagree with is what has grown up to be the culture of controlling them, which is rich people paying a lot of money to get a trophy stag. And that still continues in that.
Taxidermy and not to even eat.
Oh, yeah. And that continues to this day. And that also encourages some people to keep the overpopulation of deer up.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So we haven't really agreed as a country in Scotland what we're going to do about the deer.
Okay.
But no one really denies that.
Right. I mean, even
Lyme's disease in England. Mm-hmm. I mean, England's got a big problem with too many deer as well. And in other countries, it is kept down by people who shoot.
Yeah.
And there's not so many people doing it in the UK now.
Right.
Mm. Well, there's people shooting, but for sport, not for
food.
And the different kind of meat you can get. So I've had muntjac. I've made a video about that. That's really delicious.
Oh, really?
Those are the little... You probably thought it was a dog if you saw it crossing the road.
Would you?
The tiny little deer. And it has tusks rather than...
Brilliant.
As well as antlers. Yeah. There's lots of those in the countryside.
Tusks and antlers.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a wolverine.
Mm-hmm. I remember going to Lake Baikal in Russia and
seeing a stuffed wolverine in the local museum.
You know what I mean?
That was ever a real thing.
So muntjac. So again, we don't know what's on our own doorsteps, you know? Lots of people are running to the supermarket to get meat, and there's lots of really good meat in our countryside, which tastes better.
Yeah.
And it's more fun.
Yeah, hell yeah. And you're eating something there's too much of.
Mm. Yeah, and that was part of the motivation, again, for the book. There's a muntjac. See his little tusks?
Oh, wow. Look!
There's loads of those in the countryside.
Did muntjac. A boar make love to a...
Yeah, a deer.
Does look like that.
They're from China originally.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. I should have cooked you muntjac.
Wow. Another time.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. We'll do that next time with your vegetable book.
Yeah, completely wrong topic.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's just have a
when
chat.
In Rome.
Yeah, yeah. So that was one of the motivations of the book, in that at the beginning, I'll just take you through why I did it. I was like, I ought to be vegetarian.
Right.
But then I'd be somewhere like Scotland. My family are all Scottish. And they'd be like, but this is venison I had to shoot.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, well, that's okay. But I didn't want to be a sort of vague, so I started the idea of only eating animals I killed myself.
Yeah.
And then I said it to people, and they were so fascinated, especially metropolitan men, who were like, what's that like? I want to do it. You know, they were so fascinated. And I just realised we didn't really know, and it linked in with what I was trying to write about ultimately, which was things we can do to live more lightly on the planet and to tackle climate change. So then I decided to do it, and that's where it started, really. Can you be an ethical carnivore?
Yeah. Can you be an ethical anything? Once you exist, we're here making these great big footprints everywhere in any sense.
Mm. I mean, the philosophical side of it, I don't have a degree in philosophy, but how I explain it is morals are rules, and you have to stick to those rules. But I read a definition of ethics, which was the effort to live a good life.
Right.
So it's an effort to live a good life, the ethics of the ethical carnivore, it's the effort to eat meat well.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a get-out clause, but
that,
it's
the effort to eat meat well.
Yeah, or I the love effort, that. Ethics is, yeah, the ethic, I have heard, yeah, it has been defined as the ethic. Effort to live a good life. But so that's how I went into it, really, thinking, okay, if I'm gonna try my best, what I really need to do is only eat animals I kill myself, which is slightly extreme, but I'm really glad I did it, and I miss it.
Amazing.
Yeah, I miss it. I miss
Like you said, you can keep it up.
Yeah, a little bit, but I miss the discipline of it.
Right.
Yeah.
But for some of those things, it sounded like it was a big adventure as well to go and do that, let alone the learning side of it. You know, it's not, you can't, where, I know, I suppose it depends where you live and how you live. But when you're in a city and you're, you know.
Absolutely. And people say, I would like to do it. And I have to say, because I wanted to write the book in London.
Yeah.
But I ran out, I just couldn't afford to live in London.
Yeah.
Writing a book. But you could.
Yeah.
But it takes quite a lot of time or money again. So.
Right.
So you can pay to do these things, Or if you live in the countryside and you befriend a gamekeeper,
yeah,
you could effectively do it for free, but you need the time and effort to do that. So I always argue you can do it if you want to for nothing. Yeah. Like learn how to kill and butcher and eat animals. But yeah. It is inaccessible. You know, yeah. I must admit it is inaccessible to most people. So that's why I wrote the book, so you can read it.
Amazing. It's brilliant. There's a wonderful line in the book about carnivores being defensive, like... like dogs having their water bowl taken away, growling. I've also had sometimes that experience from vegans as well. I think perhaps it's just a matter of absolutism. I know I've said that before, but I think it's because there's comfort in feeling like you've chosen to do a right thing and that what you're doing's right.
I definitely think it works for a lot of people. So, like I said, I have a generally positive feedback from the book because a lot of vegan vegetarians I know are pretty relaxed about it around the edges.
Yeah.
And I actually think
often the things that you had hunted that your had vegan friends happy to eat.
Yes, yeah. One of the myths that I think I tried to break down in the book, and I certainly have found after it, is everyone's said, you know, there's that joke, you know, how can you tell someone's vegan? Don't worry, they'll tell you.
Yeah.
Actually, I haven't found that to be the case at all. I found most people to be really interested in my book and willing to have an exchange. And so there's a spectrum, and most people, vegan and vegetarians, fit in that as well, in that if they've read it or they're interested in it, they want to have a debate, like any civilised person, and they don't expect anything from how they eat. There's I think it's a little bit of a myth that vegans are all sort of really extreme.
Of course.
So, but then at the either end of that, there is fundamentalists. So at one end are vegans who are philosophical vegans who believe it's wrong to kill and possibly quite fundamentalist and are angry with me. Okay. But then at the other end of the spectrum, there are people who love to eat meat who are angry with me because I've been pointing out where it comes from. So I got it from both sides, actually.
Yeah, I bet.
But less than I thought I would.
Right.
Much less than I thought I would. I mean, when I wrote the book, I was really careful. I started blogging and I put up pictures. I tried to sort of gently introduce it just to see, you know, where I could push.
Yeah.
Because you can get some really nasty stuff. And I got much less than I thought I would. Having said that, a lot of people who work with me, and they do tend to be, so far, the worst have been a female photographer and a chef. I've got very nasty stuff. And you don't realise, because as a journalist, I've been a journalist for 10 years, so to me, online abuse, I'm like, oh, don't even notice.
Yeah.
And some of it's misogynistic, and I'm not even going to say it out loud, but it's, you know, it's a murderer ethical, but worse things than that, or like specifically towards a female, worse things than that, which frightened people who work with me, and that was horrible. But I don't really worry about it too much because I kind of think those people would be doing that to someone somewhere anyway.
They're probably scattergun.
Exactly. So yeah. But it upset me that it might put people off working with me, which it sometimes has.
Oh God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's understandably
obsessive. I mean, it did a little bit of TV, but mostly they don't want to know, even though it's a fascinating subject, because of the challenges. And it doesn't work with TV. Like, you can't film the killing of an animal and explanation. I think it only really works with a book because you've got to write about your feelings.
But also
you take the reader with you.
You can read a book at your own pace. I mean, you can't read or hear something. You can pause it, perhaps. But he does that, really. I mean...
Yeah.
Actually, my boyfriend does have a science sort of poetry, but that's because he's a dweeb.
The interesting thing was, after the book, I thought, right, I have to be vegan because that's the next logical conclusion, because I really did say at the end of the book the easiest and best thing is to be vegan. So I did try it for a while. I think I did Veganuary and then I tried to carry it on.
Yeah.
Because I was planning on writing about it at that time, I also went and spoke to nutritionists and stuff because I thought, I can't write about it unless I really know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And they said, yep, it's really challenging. You have to know about all your food combinations. Mm-hmm. And I'm a bit lazy. And so I didn't keep on top of that. So I ended up having binges and quite an unhealthy diet.
Right, yeah.
And then they also did say to me, I'm getting a lot of people who are
who are having trouble with their nutrition because they're vegan. That sort of made me think.
And
then I just thought, well, it was about control and denial and all these things. And so I thought, I'm actually more interested in why I'm doing this and why people feel so great about it. And then that led me to think about my own disordered eating as a child at school.
Yeah.
And to write a piece about that, actually.
That's how I came across you first, that article.
Actually, to be completely honest with you, that article had sat in a drawer for a few years since, and I'm sure he won't mind me mentioning him, a guy called Alex Renton, who wrote a book called The Boarding School Syndrome. And it's all about what boarding schools do to little boys. Right. And I read it, and I went to boarding school, and I thought, no one's talking about what it does to girls. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to most women in this country, Jess, and you say, oh, pretty much 80% of my class had some sort of eating disorder, they'll go, eh. Yeah. They won't go, oh my God, that's awful.
No, go, I know from this podcast.
Yeah. They'll go, oh yeah. I mean, some people sort of do, but they're so those sort of nice people.
Yeah.
You know, very, the type. Very, you know, some people are like, oh my God, that's awful. And they're either a bit older and a bit naive like that, or they're just terribly, terribly nice. And I wish the world was full of them.
Yeah.
But it ain't. So most people will just sort of nod and take it for granted. And I just remember thinking, and that was a journalistic instinct kicking in. It's like when everyone's accepting something and no one's pointing it out, that's the story. So I'm like, you know, I've got to go and write about that. And then I thought, well, I can't write about it unless I bring myself in. But I can't do that. Right. And then it was years later when I suddenly realised, when I suddenly found myself in the position, I'm a food writer.
Yes. And I've gone from an environmental writer. Yeah.
Yeah, to food writer. And I welcome that.
Yeah.
Frankly, people question this, but yeah, anyone who's a writer doesn't be like, I don't care what you call me.
You're paying me to write that stuff I'm interested in. You can call it whatever you like.
Exactly. So I was like, and also there's loads of really wonderful people and food is really important. And I think sometimes when people put it down, they don't want to be called a food writer. It's because they don't want to be associated with the feminine and domestic because it's less important. And I was like, well, I'm not going to reject that. I'm going to embrace it wholeheartedly. But I did find myself sort of tweeting about my lunch and all that sort of stuff. And promoting a more perfect side of my eating than exists.
Yeah.
And then trying to live up to that. And then discovering really good food writers like MFK Fisher. She's my absolute all-time favourite. And they don't write about food. They really write about appetite and how food makes you feel. And I thought, if I'm really honest, food makes me quite stressed. And then I thought back to that article and... So when I explored the veganism thing, I went down a completely different road.
Yeah.
And I just don't think... it just didn't suit me.
Yeah.
Is it okay to say that?
Oh, it's absolutely okay to say that. No, it's brilliant. It's not awful. I think it's brilliant. And also, I feel like I'm on exactly the same page in the sense that it jarred a bit with everything I've sort of been working on as well. I think it's... well, first things first, you started that whole thing by saying you're lazy. You're not.
Yeah, I know. Isn't
years
that awful?
Learning how to, kill things in the most efficient way, to connect with it, to respect it, etc. I mean, that's not what a lazy person does.
Mm.
But also, off the back of that, I want to say I found a very similar thing through doing this podcast and having all these conversations with people about eating and actually talking about... wanting to talk about the joy in eating. I did feel like it was possible to do that without sort of outing myself at least to a therapist, and then and I hadn't expected to talk about it so early in this. I thought, let's see, within 6 months, if it comes up naturally in a conversation, depending on where I'm at in therapy. And then my second ever episode happened to be with a woman who's a dear friend who was like, let's talk about your binging. Okay, let's, all right then. But it was so interesting. But what it's also meant is to promote this podcast, etc. I've ended up being full honest about trying to be intuitively as the podcast's gone on. I've become increasingly anti diet, anti-restricted eating. I know that for me, I'm not my wellest when I'm recording everything that I eat, when I'm overthinking it, when I'm overanalyzing, which sounds hypocritical because my Pride and Joy is a podcast all about eating. But I can't count a calorie, when I found myself going down the warren of stricter and stricter around the veganism, I had a very similar thing where I was like, I know that psychologically what's happening for me here is a type of control and rule set, and it is a type of restriction, even though you're not doing it for the stereotypical reasons. And so actually just slackening the reins was very helpful for me.
And I do sort of feel the need to say sometimes that it's not I'm not saying that all vegans have got a control issue or something like that.
Not at all.
But it's just perhaps if you were still working something out as I was, as you were, then, you know, recognising that you're maybe using something, just recognising what's happening. Interesting, isn't it? Because we're writers and we're at that stage in life where we are working things out and wanting to do things better. I'm not sort of being like, oh, I can't sort of touch a sort of sensitive vegan person. I just think that it's all getting muddled up between eating and all these sorts of things. But at the same time, I think it's quite a healthy debate. Like the body positive movement and the intuitive eating stuff, I never really would have gone down that path except for I found myself writing about food, and to be honest, it really interests me.
I think it's amazing,
and I think it's really positive because I do think that there are young girls out there who are able to look at pictures of Instagram of people of different shapes and sizes, and I think that's got to be a good
thing. Who adore themselves
and who are sort of actively questioning
everything we've been brought up to believe. I was definitely brought up by two people who I think find fatness repulsive, pretty repulsive. But simultaneously, one of them was a feeder. So, I mean, and I think lots of people have that, right? Loads of people have that, or some version of that. I think it's the first, it feels like the first time since I've been alive that there's something happening where it's changing and we're not just seeing something shameful in bigger bodies, but seeing something really beautiful. And also, I don't know, it's the same as when you were saying about talking that to diversity. Nutritionists. I'm talking about dietitians, nutritionists' views on veganism, and it feels pretty divided. I'd also want to have conversations with a much broader spectrum of those people, but the same things about, I think about sort of weight and health, I think that's... there's some lot of division over that as well.
Yeah.
There's a school of dietitians coming through that are very much connected with psychology, I think.
Yes.
And actually overwhelming kind of... I feel that they're currently pretty swayed by the idea that... So it might be that physiologically you're less likely to die of a heart attack young if you're in a leaner body. You're less likely to get cancer if you're in a leaner body. I get that. That if someone isn't meant to be in a leaner body because of either their genetics, how hungry they are, do you know what I mean? Or how they're, or the different ways they eat, because it's not just body hunger. But do you know what I mean? Like, or because they want this great, great life. Then actually, if they're well in the coconut, if they're well in the head and happy, it's like you were saying, to be happy, to be as close as we can to happy, then that's more important. To me.
Can I just say, in that happiness thing, that we're both picking up our rabbit now and gnawing the bone. It's really satisfying having a whole carrot. I think I've just eaten the end of a carrot, but I think that's good.
I think it's good. But, get the whole carrot.
But the fact that you're picking up because we've got a leg and a saddle, and when I was little,
got a leg and a saddle each.
My favourite bit was the saddle, and you can't really, I don't think I'm quite as greedy as I was when I was little. But I find that, this is maybe a slightly twisted thing to say, but I find the top of the spine really beautiful.
Really?
I always wanted the saddle so that I could really pick at it and get this bit that's like a sort of tiara or something. It's like a crown. I mean, I'm quite sure our spines would be the same.
Oh, yeah, look. God, that's a really tasty bit as well.
Yeah. Well, that's where
the most rabbity bit of rabbit.
That's fillet steak.
Is it?
The fillet steak is runs down the spine.
Wow.
Yeah. So when you butcher a cow or something big like that,
that's where the fillet steak.
I have actually done fillet steak from a squirrel, but it was.
Have you?
Well, it was with this gamekeeper. He was like, "Oh, the fillet steak," but he was very skilled knifeman. Usually, right. That's a bit tough. But with a big, when you're looking at a big cow and it's hanging up, the fillet steak is that those wow. You know, the muscles going down the side of the spine. Wow. So yeah, that's picking up the rabbit and going, food and happiness.
Yeah, food and happiness. Had an Austrian grandmother who would always suck everybody's bones.
Mm.
She was brought up in the war, and wrong side of it.
Yeah.
She would. There would be no waste.
Interesting.
She was like a sparrow. She was this tiny appetite, but she'd wait, and then when everybody's scraps were left, she'd just suckle everything. And as a child, you'd be like, ugh.
I was kind of brought up like that.
And that's very cool.
When I was at uni, I'd wait till everyone left the house, and then I'd finish off all their cereal, and then bike to school. And I was like, it was such an efficient way to have breakfast. So I was sort of like...
I kind of do that with other people's wine, but
Yeah.
Mind sweeping, exactly.
I'm in my tum.
When I wrote that article, I wrote a piece in The Observer about eating disorder badly in the past and just about what I felt was a very common story for a lot of women that they might have in the past and just to sort of own that and feel confident to write and enjoy and keep trying with food even though you haven't been good in the past, because the amount of response I got from people, sometimes from people who've been quite ill in the past but wanted to work in food and were treated in a certain way because people could see they were uncomfortable or they were really thin, and I was like, no, you can do it, why not? Like, it's like saying every doctor has to be really healthy.
Oh my God.
They're not. The only person I know who smokes Marlboro Reds is a nurse.
I was going to say nurses on a night out, days.
Yeah, exactly. But so
you don't want them in your audience.
But when I wrote that article, I didn't consult any doctors or anything. Yeah. It was just from the heart, and that was what it was about. And afterwards, I got lots of responses from people and quite a few from parents talking about their kids, which I tried to respond to, not to tell them answers, because obviously I'm not a doctor. But I did respond, and I did actually phone up a few doctors because I wanted to know that I was giving...
Yeah, well, therapists.
Yeah. Well, that crossover has got to be much stronger.
Yeah.
And it was actually doctors who I spoke to who were working in more serious eating disorders, to be honest. But it was just to make sure, because I was saying to people... Basically, I was saying that talking is a good thing and stuff like that. And I really have to make sure that's okay, before I give any advice to anyone who's actively asked me for advice. And they were really supportive. And then as I got to talk to them, it just occurred to me how important mental health is. And my article is really about, you know, what's happening to... was about women and I guess often it's quite middle-class women and all the rest of it. But there's this massive binge eating disorder happening in society as a whole where people don't have much choice and they're being overloaded with lots of cheap calories. And no one talks about that. No one talks about the fact that people who are really quite ill, it's a mental health problem. And I never considered that before or linked it to my... And it's funny how... Or linked it to my own experience. And it sounds like... kind of ridiculous thing to me to say if I'm not doing anything about it, but I don't know, sometimes opening up about your own issues and talking to other people does kind of open you up, wake you up to what's happening
absolutely
in the world.
I get lots of contact from people in all sorts of positions and I think I'm not qualified to help you, but but you know, maybe actually just being honest about your own situation, ongoing journey as much as you can do, really. The people contacting us know that we're not a doctor or a therapist. You've got some brilliant resources in your book, links to brilliant resources, for example, that Fish to Fork, which is a website where you can, basically, you can, if you're out buying fish, you put the details of it in this website, so it gives you a scale of 1 to 5, doesn't it, as to how good it is.
And ethically. The Marine Conservation Society have got an app.
That's it.
Yeah, they're really good. And then Fish to Fork is more restaurants.
Okay.
Yeah, they're both pretty good. And you feel quite awful and smug.
But not that getting awful. It out, pretty yeah. Good, but
really good. It used to be a sort of little wallet brochure that you'd sort of bring out, yeah.
But if I was going to ask, can you hazard a guess, though, generally, that if you're at the seaside and it's a fishmonger's, it should be pretty ethical to eat?
No, not at all.
Really?
Not at all. So the reason is because fishmonger's got to make a living, right?
Yeah.
So how likely is it that the 5 fish that we eat, which is salmon, prawn, haddock, tuna...
And cod,
is going to be in his waters?
No, but if you're going there and getting something that's not that, like a mullet or a bream...
Yes, but...
Get the one you haven't heard of.
Well, it often depends, because sometimes you walk in and you say, can you give me advice and stuff, and they don't really know. Yeah. I just don't want to be unrealistic to people.
Because, I know, I keep asking you for a really quick fix.
Yeah.
A quick fix. Well, it's
you often go in, and I often do this with butchers, because butchers often have Danish ham in and Danish bacon, because it's cheap.
Right.
So you do have to ask questions about stuff. But if you're by the sea and you go into a fishmonger and you ask for the local, they probably have got that down, because they know that there is that, those customers. And I always say it's worth asking, because then they'll think, oh, maybe I should get that in.
Do supermarkets sell any fish that's like not the big 5 that's like...
Yeah, they do. Actually, Asda with Marine Stewardship Council, a lot of them sell things like river cobbler, which is... It's a pretty name for, I can't remember the official name, but the official name is something like mud cod or something
mud
like
cod,
that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's something, it's that,
great.
But you can, and that can be raised on freshwater farms.
Right.
And it's been sold. So they are actually doing quite a lot.
Yeah.
And they've got, a lot of them are signed up to the Marine Stewardship Council, but it irritates me that how many of them put responsibly sourced on the side of everything.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, and you're like, oh, that means that's okay then. But how the hell do you know? It's Tesco saying that Tesco is responsibly sourcing.
They're judging themselves with those badges.
Yeah,
basically.
And sometimes they claim it's because it's better than the trade, like this has happened recently with Fair Trade, because they've got a better idea. But it frustrates me, because I just think the consumer can't be expected to believe you.
Yeah.
Like, you haven't been that great in the past. So
yeah.
I feel like they've got to... it would be nicer if they just stuck to like labels we can all understand.
Yeah, absolutely. That we're honest. But then perhaps Brexit is going to fuck that up big time.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a picture of empty plates with a book in the middle of them.
Oh, I can... And we're suggesting with photographers, I can gnaw something. And I was like, Louise, eating pictures are never good.
I love it. Oh, God, I'm eating in most of my pictures. I bought way too much of this. So I'm staying with friends in Durham this week.
Amazing. That's why I thought you were from Durham.
No, I live in London.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's really great that you came up.
So these are vegan. An apricot flapjack, that's apparently peanut
butter.
Did you
make it?
No, there's this incredible stall in the Durham city centre called the Green Gorilla.
Yummy.
And it's like marketed as being like strong veggie food with attitude. There's a big muscly gorilla on the front.
Northern men make them.
Then it needs to be strong and muscly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, God, this. But that's a biscotti brownie, an Oreo brownie, an apricot flapjack, and a peanut butter flapjack.
Oh my God.
I'll be
amazing.
Honest, I'm not big into flapjacks, but I want to try both these.
I want to try the apricot.
Do it.
Flapjack.
I'm just going to get my hands in. Is that all right?
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
Biscotti.
So you like the rabbit? You like rabbit?
I loved
it. Will
the
you
rabbit.
Eat it again?
Yes.
That's good.
I need to work out where I can get it.
I thought you lived in the north, so.
I live in southeast London, but I spend probably a quarter of my life in Swanage in Dorset, where I'm from.
Oh, lovely.
My parents are still there and stuff. Lots of
friends. Just local butchers.
Mm.
Yeah, we usually have local rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they will. Or game dealers.
Okay.
Or game. If you chat up a gamekeeper or a farmer, you get all these things for free.
Really?
Yeah, especially pheasant.
I love chatting up farmers. Okay, great. I grew up chatting up farmers.
Yeah.
Trump decides he wants the biggest dinner in the world and offers billions, probably of US taxpayers' money, for the biggest vegetables ever. One farmer has gone nutbags for this and started growing a turnip so big it's actually used up all the moisture in the ground and all the nutrients for a 200-mile radius and thereby killed off millions of other plants and beasts in the process. She says she'll stop and denounce the cash and go back to a happy, helpful life, but only if you, and weirdly it does have to be you,
yeah,
carry a Fiat 500 all the way up Arthur's Seat all by yourself just with a rope attached to a rucksack. It's sweaty business, but you do but you're so tired and you're you know that post exercise of like you're allowed a shower or whatever and then it's like what an hour later and that and you're hungry and your reward is the feast of your dreams. So the food doesn't need to exist, it doesn't need to be accessible, and nor do any of the answers to this. So I want to know what would be your dream meal. What would you eat, what would you drink, who with and where?
I think there is something so satisfying about my favourite meals are either ones where you just have a really delicious starter and then a really delicious pudding and you kind of don't waste any room on the main course.
Yes.
Right? So that's one type that I really love. And it often means that you crash later on and you're hungry. It's not really that healthy. But it sometimes is really satisfying, especially when you're drunk.
Yes.
You know, when you're drunk and you're excited.
Yes.
And you're just trying all this other stuff. So that's what. So I was going to go in with that. But then I also thought about, there are times in my life when I've been out to dinner, and it's usually not in Britain because we don't think we're as good at it. It's usually in the continent, you know, like France or Spain, and where they know how to eat so it makes you happy.
Oh, yeah.
And so the alcohol, you drink loads, but you don't have a hangover and you never feel really full.
Oh.
So it's between those two things. But I think I would have...
Moderates.
I'm gonna sort of choose food that I've tried before, because I had an amazing cocker leeky soup once. Ooh. With scallops in it. But they have to be hand-dived scallops.
Yes, hand-dived scallops.
To start. And then I'd have roast pheasant with all the trimmings.
Oh.
All the trimmings. I mean, maybe not Yorkshire pudding. I didn't get that excited about Yorkshire puddings.
Excuse me, you're wrong.
No. Okay, I'd have roast parsnips in there. Definitely roast parsnips. And mashed potato and roast pheasant and what kind of, leeks, carrots, like just a really lovely sort of hearty meal. And then pudding, my favourite pudding in the world is raspberry pavlova.
Excellent.
Would it all fit together? That's the thing. I want to have a meal where you'd feel amazing. You know, like chefs, really good chefs are the ones who... So I might bring in a chef to adapt all my flavours.
Perfect. What a great idea. Yes. So that they become a story and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and so it makes me feel amazing and the wine all suits it. Not so I get too full or I feel bad.
Well, maybe this can take hours and it won't matter because you're in such good company.
And there
will
be lots of people.
Would you?
I love eating with people.
Great.
It's like I love watching TV with people.
Yes.
Like, what's the point if you can't talk around it and share it and I'd be quite, there'd definitely be booze.
Yes. I've got a favourite.
Cider.
Me too. I'm a West Country girl.
Yes. So as an aperitif, definitely. Yeah. And I love it. I love that. Yeah.
Lush. Get in.
Yes. Thank it'd be you. A delicious meal. And I love that we talked a lot about how food can make people happy, and it's just like it's such a integral part of who we are and how we communicate and stuff. So I think that I don't want to be one of those people who's like, oh, in this country we've lost this or we've lost that, because that gets a bit boring. But we definitely sometimes, I think, because it's so accessible and we're all moving so fast, have forgotten how to enjoy it.
Yeah just remember to enjoy it.
Yeah.
What an absolute honour to talk to someone so frank, informed and articulate. I implore you, please, buy Louise's book, The Ethical Carnivore. It's totally compelling and full of the most fascinating information and ideas, but it just seems to pour off the page. I've made it sound heavy, but it's not as effortless reading. And it really fills up your mind with insight and ideas and questions and inspiration. It's brilliant, and God, it would make an amazing present actually for anyone even faintly interested in where their food comes from. And Louise is on Twitter at Lou, L-O-U-B Gray, and Gray is with an A, so at L-O-U-B-G-R-A-Y. The amazing article that she wrote about being a food writer with bulimia was in The Observer. It's Googleable, but it's also, I've put a link to it pretty high up in the podcast notes, so check those out. I link to everything that we mentioned in these podcasts in those notes. If you go to Brilliant Acast, where the podcast is streamed from, that's where all the notes will be. And there, on them, if it's written in capitals, that means it's a link to a website. It's a bit hard to see on that page. So please tell everyone you've ever met about this podcast. That's how we're spreading it. That's how we're growing it. You could do even more of it. I'm sure you could do even more of it. I know there's a couple of absolute winners out there who are doing loads of it. And the rest of you, up your game. Follow us on social media at The Hoovering Pod. You can rate, review, subscribe. I think all that helps. Follow me too, at Jessica Foster Q. I'd love to see you at my live shows. They're all listed on my silly website, jessicafosterq.com. And that's where you can send me a longer message to if you want to, an email. That's what they call it, don't they? These days, in these modern days. And last but not least, if you've got any spare pennies, as I said at the beginning of the episode, please go to patreon.com/thehooveringpod. And if you are my patron already, I'm so grateful. You're doing top work. Come to the live shows in January while there's still tickets. We've probably only got a few weeks left until they're all sold out. unrestrictedview.co.uk/the-podcast-live. Hoovering is produced by Emma Corsham and the music is by Mike Greenway. Until next week, happy hoovering.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.